Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Very happy to be visiting here at Chevron Corporation once again. I think this is the third time that I have been here, and so today I'm happy to offer some reflections on the subject of mindfulness, sati, and so that the words that we say in our Dhamma talks are, say, offered in the spirit of reflection. So things I say shouldn't be, you shouldn't assume they're absolutely true, but they're ways of thinking and seeing that people are invited to look at, to try out for yourself, and to see whether they are true from your own experience. So nowadays, the word mindfulness you see in many, many places, not just here in Thailand, a Buddhist country, but all over the world. Probably many of you are aware of that. You see mindfulness programs in universities, in schools, in businesses, even in the military, in the prisons, in the criminal justice system. And so that's just occurred within the last 10 or 12 years that we see the word mindfulness everywhere. So I thought I might share with you, just to begin with, a little bit of a history of why we see that around, you know, that maybe some of you are interested. If not, that's okay too. the founder in the West of the of a system of using mindfulness as a form of mind training was a man called Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he was at working at a hospital in Massachusetts, Worcester, Massachusetts. And he was a long-time Buddhist meditator. He derived a lot of benefit from Samatha Vipassana, from concentration and insight meditation for many years. And he was a doctor. He was working in the mental health field, and also a doctor in a public hospital. So he was looking for ways to somehow bring Buddhist meditation into the field of medical treatment. In America, quite different from many other Western countries, there's a very strong religious perspective, mostly Christian, Protestant Christian perspective. And they have, at least in the law, a separation of church and state. So that anything that's run by the state, like a public hospital, can't be biased towards a particular religion. It has to be independent of religions, theoretically. So anyway, Dr. Kabat-Zinn, he reflected on this, and he came up with this program, an 8-week program that he called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. And basically, it's training individual in mindfulness and in concentration practices, and using a language that's completely free of Buddhist terminology, and mostly using psychological, Western psychological terms. But the actual training and the changes brought about within the mind for the individual person was very much in harmony, in keeping with Buddhist meditation practices. So it was a kind of undercover Buddhism, you know, what they call a stealth Buddhism, yeah. With a skillful intention, wholesome intention. That was in 1978, so more than 40 years ago he launched that program. And over many years that began to show very good results, not just for mental health and mental stress, but also physical well-being, so particularly for things like heart disease, hypertension, and also the recovery from injuries and so forth, that there were many studies done that showed that people who were practicing MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, then there were a lot of physical benefits and mental benefits coming from that. So that was a steady interest began to develop around the world because of the success of those programs. And that was the case until about the year 2004, 2005. So one of the areas that was most difficult, particularly in the public health around the world, and specifically in mental health, was the issue of depression and what they call recurrent depression. So that means someone having not just a single episode of depression for a few weeks or a few months, but a person's had a period of depression, they've recovered, and then they relapse again. It comes back again. So that's called recurrent depression. So around the world, over the last 100 years, no treatment of any kind had a better than 10% recovery rate. So that out of 100 people who had recurrent depression, the maximum was 10 could possibly recover, 90 would not recover. So between 5 and 10%, that was the best results anyone had. Whether it was medication, surgery, psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, any kind of treatment, nothing was had a better than a 10% recovery rate. So, some of the people who were involved with Dr. Kabat-Zinn, three scientists, John Teasdale from Cambridge University in England, and Zindel Siegel in the University of Toronto, and Mark Williams at the University of Oxford, these three got together and they thought, well, can we develop a kind of mindfulness-based stress reduction that works for depression, specifically targeted at this particular kind of mental illness? And so John Teasdale, apparently it was from listening to Lumpur Sumato give a Dhamma talk, which I feel is obviously quite proud of. But he was listening to a Dhamma talk of Ajahn Sumato, who was the founder of Amaravati Monastery. He was the first Western, first Western disciple of Thanajan Chah. John Teasdale, listening to a talk of his, talking about meditation on thinking and skillful attitudes towards thought. And from some of the things he heard Ajahn Sumato saying in that Dhamma talk, then he came up with the idea for what's called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression, the MBCT. So not to get too technical. But anyway, so these three, Mark Williams, Zindel Siegel, John Teasdale, they developed this program. And they ran a study with a number, maybe 50 or 60 subjects in the UK. They experienced a 50% recovery rate, so 500% better than anything else in the previous 100 years. So when they published that in about 2005, 2006, I think. And then people said, this is nonsense, this is crazy, there's no medicine involved, there's no surgery involved, there's no, this is just people meditating, just watching their minds, and you get this kind of result. This is impossible. You must have fudged your figures. You must have massaged the statistics, as they say. This can't be true. And so then they ran the study again in the USA, and they got the same result, a 50% recovery rate. So that's when we started seeing mindfulness being mentioned everywhere, because that had a huge impact around the world. Because you're probably not aware, since you're in the fuel industry, but in the medical world, or maybe you are actually, since this is the corporate sector, there are more work days lost through depression than any other kind of illness or injury around the world. So twice as many work days all around the planet, from the Western world, Asia, and South America, Africa, Australia, and everywhere. More than twice as many work days lost in the working year through depression than through hand injury or eye injury, back injury, heart disease, anything of that nature. So depression is also a major economic issue as well as a personal sort of mental health issue. So at that point, people got very interested in mindfulness. Well, this is amazing. How can this be true? Well, this they proved this, so tell me more. Let's find out about this. So that was about 2007. So that's been the last 12 years. So since then, the amount of interest in mindfulness, yeah, I'm sure you do graphs here in Chevron. I saw some a graph on the whiteboard in the room we're sitting in. So the graph kind of goes up like a hockey stick. You know, it climbs rapidly. So now you have thousands and thousands of academic studies on mindfulness every year, and you have the interest in mindfulness programs in the corporate world, in the educational fields, primary schools, high schools, universities, in the military, as I was saying, in the prisons, in the criminal justice system, kind of everywhere, people are seeing that mindfulness is something that is beneficial. Even the British government, amazingly enough, they launched a program in October of 2016 called Mindful Nation UK, and 20% of the members of part of the UK Parliament and of the House of Lords, they signed up to it and said, yes, this is something we support. And both on the left wing and right wing, conservative and Labour members of the Parliament and the House of Lords signing up for this as something they see as being valuable. So I'm kind of encouraged by that. It's made a lot more work for us because now we have at Amravati, where I live, we have a retreat center there as well as the monastery, and so we have the waiting lists for the retreats are now like 200 or 300 people long. But I think that's a good problem. And so that I was also, when the subject for today was suggested as mindfulness, then I thought this is an indication of that growing interest around the world in this subject, and also that people can say make use of these trainings. Whether you happen to be a Buddhist or a Christian or a secular materialist or a Muslim or whatever your background might be, it's a way of mind training, of working with your own life, your own mind, that can bring about a great deal of benefit for yourself and for others. So when we use the word mindfulness, it's a single word, but it can cover a wide range of meanings. Also, I am obviously speaking in English, and we're in Thailand, so we'll have a question and answer session at the end. So anything that I have been saying that's not clear, then you'll have an opportunity to ask about, that I'll be happy to clarify, but I'll just carry on speaking in English. My Thai is very poor, so it's much easier for me to do it this way. So when we speak about mindfulness, then it's a single word, but it covers a big range of meanings. And so Lumpo Cha, our teacher, the great meditation master from northeast Thailand, where I was became a monk all those years ago, he would talk about basically that there's three different layers of mindfulness, or three different qualities that are embodied within mindfulness, from the very coarse to the very refined. So the basic kind of mindfulness, he'd say, it's like a cat has mindfulness. When a cat is trying to hunt a mouse looking for a mouse in the it's looking, it's listening, it's paying attention, it's very focused on what's going on. So he said, that's sati, that's mindfulness. Or a garok, a squirrel jumping through the Wat Pa Pong has lots of squirrels. Lots of garok, you know, jumping through the branches. Say, you know, a garok, a squirrel, has to have a lot of sati. You know, it needs to be able to aim for the right branch and jump according to with the right strength and land without falling to the ground. So he'd say, this is a kind of sati, a basic sort of sati that we can develop and is important. It's paying attention deliberately in the present moment. So also I wanted to talk about these three different layers, because sometimes when we see mindfulness programs being presented in schools or in businesses or in other areas, it can focus just on this ability to pay attention to the present. So I'd say that's a kind of functional mindfulness, or you could say mechanistic, just a sort of mechanical, basic mindfulness, So that's mindfulness at the most coarse level. So that's also the kind of mindfulness that you would say, like a cat catching a mouse. The cat is not thinking about what the mouse feels about it. Am I? The cat just wants to eat. So the cat is being mindful to a degree, but that kind of basic mindfulness doesn't take into account the effects that you're having on the other. So if a cat thought, I wonder what that mouse will feel like if I jump on it and bite into it, it won't be very happy. So a cat, I would say, doesn't think that way. Maybe some of you are cat owners and think, you don't know my cat. My cat's a very spiritual cat. It never acts that way. So in England, the English people are very protective about their pets, their dogs and their cats. And so you have to be careful when you speak in this way about animals in England. But I think most of us understand, that's the way the animal world works. So that's the first layer of mindfulness, is a kind of mechanistic mindfulness. And it's a kind of mindfulness, but it's not the kind of sati that liberates. So I feel that, not to be too critical, but quite a lot of the programs that teach mindfulness in the, say, the business world or the educational world or the military, it's just this kind of training the mind to pay attention. But it doesn't have any kind of moral dimension. There's not the sila tam, the element of reflection of what is the impact of this action or this attitude. Like the cat doesn't think about what the mouse feels. So the second layer of mindfulness is sati sampajanya in the Pali, or mindfulness and full awareness. So that's not just focusing on a particular object, but looking at the time, the place, the situation, and also appreciating the sila tam, the aspect of morality. So the mind is able to draw upon that sensitivity of, yes, I'm interested in this, I want to go shopping, but I haven't got enough money. Should I tell my wife that I want to take an extra chunk out of the bank account to buy this new car? Well, I'll tell her later. That kind of thing. Well, that if there's sati sampajanya, then there'll be the recognition of, well, the last time I spent a lot of money without telling my partner, there was a lot of suffering. So, yes, there's this impulse to buy a new car, but this is a feeling that's arising here and now, but I should check with my partner before I spend the money, because it's her money too, these kind of things. So that this is really where mindfulness becomes far more useful, because it's, say, paying attention in the present moment, but also assessing what the impact of your attitudes, your words, your actions, your interests, what you are attracted to, what you're feeling negative about. You're assessing all of that. So it's a kind of attunement to the time, the place, and the situation. So in the workplace, this is extremely useful. So here we are in a corporation, so you obviously people work together with each other. You're in different groups, different offices, different teams, I would guess, am I? So you have to communicate with each other and work together, and you have a particular goals in mind for the company and for your own well-being. So this is where mindfulness becomes extremely important. So the sati sampajanya, mindfulness and full awareness, mindfulness and clear comprehension. Because it's what is also guiding our actions in terms of, well, I want to get this particular result. How should I speak to get that result? Now, or even more important, well, this is what I want. What do the rest of the people in the group want? Okay, I'm just one member of the team. To me, it looks like we should really do this. Definitely, this is the right thing. But before assuming that is the right thing, then we think, well, wait a minute. There's other experienced and knowledgeable people in this group. We all work we have the same kind of training and the same kind of background. Okay, what do the others think? Maybe someone's got a better idea than I have. Maybe I don't know everything. Chame? So this is not just being mindful of our own speech, but also using mindfulness to listen, to really be open, to the input other people make. Yesterday I was asked to give reflections on Dhamma at work, Dhamma in the workplace, for a landscape architecture company, P-Land company. And this is one of the points I was making, is that particularly if you're a manager or a boss, it's really important that you are ready to receive input from the people that you work with, the people that are under you, that basically to recognize that the boss is not always right. So I'm the Jawat, I'm the abbot of Amaravati Monastery in England. It's a biggish, for England, for the West, it's a big monastery. We have about 40 nuns and monks and novices, about 10, 15 lay people who live there, and usually 20, 25 guests, so that we have 60 or 70 people staying on site any one time. And so it's a big place. And so, and I have to work with a lot of people. I'm on about 15 different committees. So if you think, oh, I want to just go to the Wat, shave my head, put on robes, and leave the world behind. I've had enough of business meetings. Pull out. Bua, prachum. I'll go to the Wat. Be careful. I go to a lot of meetings. I read a lot of agendas and a lot of minutes. So if that's depressing, well, you can use mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression. The important thing in, say, working in a group, particularly if you're the boss, is to recognize other people have good ideas too, and you're not always right. And sometimes if you are sensitive and you use that position in a good way, you can ask for opinions. You can encourage people to think for themselves, to come up with their good ideas, and to share them, that they don't feel like they're attacking you or putting you down as a boss, but rather that the boss is happy to receive your input. And so I found, being the abbot, the Jawat of Amaravati, that I'm very happy to get the ideas from other people. Of course, if you're the abbot, everyone is junior to you. And so I feel, appreciative of the input that people can make, because I realize I have some talents. I'm quite good with words, but I'm not good with construction. You know, I don't have a good sense of three-dimensional space, or what buildings will work well in relationship to each other, or how different amenities will work. My mind easily works in theory, but it doesn't really work with some material objects and how things function on the ground. Other nuns and monks are really good at that. So I will ask them, say, well, we want to launch this project. What do you think? You know, and so the ideas that I've had, they'll say, well, that's not going to work because of this, 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 and this. And you go, oh, very good. That's great. Thank you. I hadn't thought of that. Now, sometimes when you're in the position of being a boss, it's very difficult to say, that's great. I hadn't thought of that. Or, you know, but usually if you're, yeah, there's a lot of attachment to your atta, to yourself. Like, yeah, well, I had thought of that, but, you know, I thought this was better. You know, you kind of defend your ego, can I? So if the boss is doing that, then usually it ends up with more stress in the system. Stress increasing rather than stress reducing. So that in terms of this aspect of sati sampajanya, that being careful with how you speak, to speak in a way that encourages respectfulness, a way that is speaking that is honest, a way of listening to receive the input from others, and really receiving it rather than, oh, thank you for sharing, like, go away. And I'm really ignoring what you're saying, but genuinely listening. So that's the second level of mindfulness. And then the third level is in a way more to do with meditation, or a more refined perspective on life. And this might sound like a little bit sort of unnecessary or a bit too abstract, but what is the third level of mindfulness we call satipanya, or mindfulness and wisdom. And that's a recognition that what we experience now is that we might say, here we are in Chevron, we're in this little lecture theatre here, and that we're in the Chevron building. But also, the Chevron building and this talk is in your mind. I close my eyes, you all disappear. Open my eyes, here you are again. So, we don't experience the world. Each one of us experiences our mind's representation of the world. What we know in our life is what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, what we think, what we remember. And that's the world that we know. We can't really know any other world. And the Buddha said that whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world, that is called the world in this Dhamma and discipline. And what is it whereby one is a perceiver and a conceiver of the world? How you see the world, how you know it, and how the mind conceives it, puts it together. It's the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. So again, that might seem a bit sort of like, well, why is that useful? Why is that important? But so if I can recognize, well, right now, here, this room here in the Chevron building, I'm seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, tasting, touching, that this moment is put together through those six senses and my memory, the language I use. And it's pieced together and it says, here we are, I've been talking for half an hour, we've got another half hour or so together, so I'll talk for another few minutes and then we'll have time for question and answer. The mind assesses the picture, but those thoughts are thinking consciousness arising and passing away. When we see, it's eye consciousness arising, passing away. Sound is hearing consciousness, ear consciousness arising, passing away. So our mind puts together its own version of the world, moment by moment. If any of you have ever seen a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Blink, which is a kind of a scientific exploration of perception, I would recommend it. I hope there's a Thai version, but if not, I recommend it in English. Because one of the things that he's a kind of popular scientist. It's like a popular science book. It's very easy to read. And what it talks about is how the mind puts together its perceptions moment by moment. How we see what we expect to see. And how our world is pieced together. So actually, our brain receives sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and then it makes a best guess of what's happening. It puts it together, kind of, okay, this is what I think is happening, here it is. How many of us say, when the light is dim, like it's twilight, and you walk outside, maybe it's a bit difficult in Bangkok because there's lots of light here, but in the countryside where the light is dim, and you see a shape, you think, oh, is that a person? Oh, it's a tree. No, it's a pillar of a house. No, it's a tree. Oh, it's Uncle Som. Okay. You know, the eye is sort of, and for a moment it's a tree, for a moment it's a pillar, for a moment it's a person. It's kind of guessing. It's trying to patch something in to fill that, to join up the dots, as we would say, to make a picture. So our perceptions are fabricated each moment. Now you might think, well, what's that got to do with corporate life or how I get on with my co-workers or how that makes me happy? So the reason why it's significant is when we recognize that we don't see the world, but we see our mind's version of the world, then when you're sitting across the table and you think, well, I think we should go for blue, and someone says, no, red, let's go for red, then if you recognize, well, this is just my version of the world, then then it's easy to let go of that, to recognize other people see things differently. I don't see the world. And sometimes when you're very intelligent, very competent, and you get used to being right, then you assume everybody else who thinks differently is wrong. They might be good people, but they're just wrong. And then if we're very smart, we can argue why they're wrong and convince ourselves why they're wrong. So if you recognize that we, each of us, can only experience our own mind's version of the world, then it's much easier to say, oh, that's interesting. She sees things completely different. My mind said, well, obviously blue's the right color for this. And then somebody else says, no, red. Red, it's got to be red. Look, because of this, this, and this. So even though that third layer of mindfulness, satipanya, recognizing our whole field of experience as a mental event of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, consciousness kind of put together, that might seem a bit sort of abstract or kind of not very practical or helpful. I would say, actually, if we remember that, then it really helps us on a practical level to harmonize with each other, to have respect for each other. So that if somebody has a different idea, a different perspective, you know, then we are able to see, well, I would never think of it that way, but why should I be right? I lived in California for a long time, and in Northern California, they're quite fond of, they have what they call bumper stickers, like a little sort of sticker you put on the back of your car, the message. So they like the kind of philosophical or spiritual bumper stickers, messages to put on the back of their car in the Bay Area. Any of you who've been in the San Francisco or Berkeley area probably familiar with the kind of thing. So one of the popular bumper stickers when I lived there was, just because you think it, it doesn't mean it's true. So that's very smart. Very profound. That's a good message to give to the world. And that's often the way it is. We assume, if I think something, that it's therefore true. If other people think differently, they're wrong. And particularly when it comes to arguments about politics, for a start, but also in the workplace, in the family, the more that we can recognize that that's a delusion, that just because we think it, it doesn't mean it's true, then we find we can make space for each other. We can make space for other people's opinions. So that's the third layer of sati, and mindfulness is of that nature. So going back to that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression, and that's a kind of Western psychological way of talking about a very ancient Buddhist meditation technique the Buddha talked about himself, which is learning how to watch the mind and watching the thoughts as they arise in the mind. It's like a mindfulness of thinking. And the Buddha describes his own meditation before he was enlightened. He says, when I was an unenlightened bodhisattva, I was sitting, meditating, and I divided my thoughts into two categories. That the thoughts that were connected with what was wholesome, what was noble, what was helpful, what was beautiful, and those thoughts I recognized and would follow, and the thoughts that were connected with what was unwholesome, destructive, and productive of suffering, those thoughts I left aside. So that there's a recognition that, you know, the thoughts that arise in our mind are of a, there's a spectrum of them, and that one of the things that Dr. Teasdale heard from Ajahn Sumedho that day was that the thoughts that arise in our mind, that they're not true. They're kind of just comments that the mind is making, that they might be significant, they might not. They might be valid, they might not. But we certainly shouldn't take them to be absolutely true. Depression often arises because the mind is saying, I'm not good enough, I'm a failure, nobody loves me, my life is useless, everything has got no point. I'm not reading anybody's mind, by the way. How did he know? That's just how depressive thoughts work. One of the senior monks in our community said when he first started meditating, he had this mantra that went, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good. So this mindfulness of thinking, which I would suggest is a very, very important aspect of developing mindfulness and the use of meditation, is to be able to listen to your thoughts. I mean, it's like you sit here and we can hear the sounds outside in the corridor, in the lobby, right? We're not particularly interested there. We might be able to hear a voice, but it's when we're hopefully listening to what I'm saying, and that's just other noises out there. If you are in your home, somebody else is watching a TV, or they're looking at something on YouTube on their iPad or their laptop, you're not particularly interested. You hear the sound, you can understand some of the words, but you didn't choose that station. You're not watching that program. You don't really care. You can understand it, but it doesn't really have any particular meaning. Mai mi kwan mai, There's no meaning or no value. You understand the words, but it's not meaningful or useful to you. So we can relate to our own thoughts in exactly the same way. It's hard to put a number on it, but I'd say something like 95% of our thoughts are just like the YouTube program your brother's watching on his laptop, or if you're in the airport, because the news program on the airport TV in the departure lounge, you're not interested, you don't really care, but it's going on. There's statements are being made, but it's just a repeat of old information, old impressions, and maimi kwan mai. There's no meaning or no value. Maimi prayod. There's no importance. So that I would suggest, even though probably most of you are paid to use your brains and to do good thinking as part of your work, for most of us, a lot of the thinking that our mind does is not useful thinking. It's not to do with our work or our life, but it's just a random internal chatter. So if we can change the attitude towards our own thinking, be mindful of thought and not give it value, just to, like Gumpo Cha would say, it's just like the chattering of the birds. It's like in the forest, you hear the birds singing. You don't know what the birds are saying. They have their own language, but it's not meaningful to you. You can let most of your thoughts just be like the chattering of the birds. And then particularly those thoughts that are self-critical and depressing, or that are filled with worry. Often it's not depression, but anxiety, like worrying what's going to happen, what should I do, I'm responsible, people expect this of me, how's it going to work, I want this to succeed, I'm afraid it's going to fail. That anxiety, ki huang, the kind of kwan huang, feng san, that kind of, I used to be a real ki huang kind of person. I was a kind of world-class worrier. And you might not believe me, but it's true. So, and it was such a common habit, it was so strong, I didn't even realize I was doing it until I'd already been a monk for about 6 or 7 years, that my basic relationship of my mind was, if it exists, worry about it. So it took me listening to Lumpur Sumedho, like close by, living in the same monastery as Lumpur Sumedho for 6 or 7 years, before I finally understood how to listen to the mind and to not believe that. There's worrying or critical thoughts, either self-critical or complaining. You know, some people's minds are, again, world-class complainers. Everything is wrong. You shouldn't be this way. That's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, and that's wrong. And this is wrong. Everything's wrong except me. Yeah. I'm always right. Everything, I'm suffering because the world is wrong. Shouldn't be this way. So that's the kind of complaining expert. So in the same, but also whether it's complaining or worrying or self-criticism, these are all patterns of thought the mind can easily create. And by developing mindfulness of thinking, learning to watch the mind and to not believe the thoughts, just let it be like the random video on YouTube or the TV in the departure lounge or your neighbor's radio playing. Just say, I'm not interested, I don't have to suppress it, I don't have to fear it, I don't have to hate it, I can just turn my attention away from that. That takes a certain amount of skill, so this is why meditation is so helpful in developing mindfulness, particularly mindfulness of thinking. But I would recommend that training the mind in meditation, learning how to concentrate, pay attention, and say encouraging the mind not to believe its thoughts too easily, then surprisingly, when you do need to think, you do need to calculate or to plan something, you can think a lot more clearly and your thoughts are a lot more effective. So it's a strange thing that by learning to let go of thought, you're able to think better. you can think more effectively when you need to by not being overwhelmed by the chattering of the mind. So these are a few reflections that I offer to you on the theme of mindfulness. I could say a lot more, but trying to be mindful of the time. I've already spoken for about 45 minutes, and we're aiming to finish by about 12:45, so I'd like to open things up for some conversations. So if anyone has any questions you would like to ask, then please don't be shy. There's a question. Did you give the microphone to
John, could you please expand a bit on mindfulness and morality?
Mindfulness and morality. Well, this is a long and ongoing debate in the this world of mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and traditional Buddhist perspectives. Because from the Buddhist perspective, if it's a genuine kind of mindfulness, if it's sammasati, you know, mindfulness which is part of the Eightfold Path, then there's an intrinsic moral element, that it can't be real mindfulness without a moral, some degree of moral sensitivity. If that isn't present, if that isn't part of it, then it's not sammasati. It's not a genuine kind of mindfulness. And Ajahn Jayasaro would say, really, that's a micha sati, a wrong kind of sati or a distorted sati. So in the military, when they talk about the sort of the mindful sniper, you know, the soldier who picks a target and mindfully aims at the target, calculates the wind speed and the how to you know, hit that person, then at that moment it's a kind of mindfulness, but it would be more like a micha sati, you know, a wrong kind of mindfulness or a distorted mindfulness. The sniper, the rifleman, is paying attention and is focused, but their appreciation of the value of the life of the person that they're about to kill is not really received in their heart. So that it's a long and ongoing debate. The people who have founded those programs, John Kabat-Zinn and then the other three cognitive therapy ones, they very deliberately left out any explicit statement about ethics and morality from the mindfulness trainings. That the 8-week program, the 10-week program for MBCT, there's deliberately no mention of if you're trying to be mindful, it's good not to tell lies, or that you should avoid killing things, or that you should be faithful to your partner. Those aspects of traditional Buddhist moral concern are consciously left out. And so that it's an active and ongoing debate. I've had a lot of correspondence myself with John Kabat-Zinn, and we're good friends. You know, it's a friendly debate, but there, particularly in the West, the Western psychotherapeutic world, it's very clearly not the role of the therapist to say you shouldn't be cheating on your wife, or that you should stop defrauding the bank if you want to be happy. That the therapist, which is kind of strange from a Buddhist perspective, but in the Western therapeutic model, the therapist, the doctor, the psychiatrist, they're not allowed to make comments about the behavior choices that the person makes, which is, to me, is kind of weird. I might have a background in academic psychology, it's one of those places where the two worlds really diverge, because from a Buddhist perspective, how could you separate those two? Because of course, if you've stolen a lot of money from the bank, you're going to have experiences of anxiety. They're connected. if you hadn't stolen from the bank, you wouldn't be so anxious. Shall I? There's a connection. If you weren't cheating on your spouse, you wouldn't be worried that they're going to find out. It's, you know, kind of, as we would say, duh, it's kind of obvious. And so from the Buddhist perspective, there's an intrinsic connection. From the Western psychological perspective, they're distinct. So that's I feel it's a good debate. It's very fruitful. My own suspicion is that within a few years' time, that behavior therapy will become mindfulness-based behavior therapy will become the new hot thing. Mindfulness is now, in the last few years, it's expanded more into compassionate activity. So mindfulness and compassion. And I feel that what's going to happen is that there'll be more and more of an appreciation of, if you don't tell lies, you don't have to worry about being found out. Yeah. If you don't kill things, you don't have to feel regret about having taken the life of another creature or another person. And, you know, and that there'll be a way that the people find of languaging it so that it's not kind of a sort of moral diktat from above, but rather it's about your own well-being and respect the lives of others. So as a natural, say, emergent quality from compassion, then, like, say, the cat's compassion for the mouse or the sniper's compassion for the target, that will become part of a progression from that. I would say from the Buddhist perspective, when there is that sati sampajanya, that mindfulness and full awareness, then in that there is the recognition of the effects of your actions. And that if you're really paying attention, you say, well, yes, I could do that, but look at the results. You know, I remember what happened last time. Like, oh, yeah, right. And I said, never again. Oh, yeah, that's right. So when the mind is tempted to something, then it's using that, ability to draw upon past experience, to reflect upon the impact of your actions. Like, I've often told the story of this. When I was living in the Bay Area, I used to go down to teach in Berkeley once a month. I would stay overnight. The monastery, Abhayagiri Monastery, is about 120 miles, about 200 kilometers north of San Francisco. So we'd drive down, and I'd give a talk in the evening in Berkeley, and then stay overnight, and then go back to Abhayagiri the next day. So there was a Thai restaurant in San Francisco that used to frequently offer a meal for the next morning. And I went along there one time, and a Thai woman came who was a friend of the restaurant owner. And she was a single mother, had a boy who was about 8 or 9 years old. And she told me the story, something that had happened in her life, and she wanted to get my feedback on whether she'd done the right thing or not. So what had happened was that she worked in an estate agent. She was a real estate agent. And one day, the office was open. She was sort of looking after the desk, and a client came in and was in a real hurry, saying, "I've got this property. I'm leaving the country in less than a week. I need to sell this really fast. I've got to kind of dissolve my assets quickly. Whatever price you can get for it, I don't mind. I just need to cash this in as quickly as possible." So she received it as a commercial property, and she said, "Well, you know, this can go from quarter of a million to half a million. Fine. Quarter of a million is great. Okay, no problem. You know, whatever you can get for it, great. Thank you so much." Took off. And then a short time later, 20 minutes, half an hour later, somebody came in, another client, and said, "I'm looking for a commercial property. This kind of size in this part of town. I've got a lot of resources. It's not exactly money, no object, but, you know, I can... for the right place, I'm happy to pay whatever the cost is." And then she said, "Well, we've got this property's just come onto our books. I could let you have it for half a million." "Half a million, great! Wow, this is just what I was looking for. Fantastic! Wow, this is just only like 500,000, right? Yep, that's we could probably get it for that. Yeah, you know, I have to talk to the seller, but I think they'll be content with half a million. Great, put my name on it. Yes, this is it. You've got a sale. So then she realized that it all happened in about 20 minutes or half an hour. No one else was around in the office. Only she knew. So her mind started going quickly. Now, she was a single mother, and she lived in a small apartment with her 8-year-old son. And he was quite good at mathematics. So she used to go through her bookkeeping work for the office with her boy to do the sums with him and to give him some experience of the working world, and to also have time together, you know, working on the figures, just have some bonding. So they lived in a very small apartment, and she realized, well, I could tell the seller we only got quarter of a million, and I can tell the buyer the price is half a million, and 250,000 goes in my pocket. No one would know, only me. So then she said, "So I was very tempted. I could see exactly how I could do it. how I could hide it in the books and no one would know. But then I decided I shouldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And so I went home that evening. I had a very difficult day, the rest of the day at the office. She said it was very difficult. But she went home that evening and she said, I told my son what had happened and also how much I was tempted. And I said to him, you know, if we had an extra $250,000, I could definitely get you that bicycle you wanted. We could move to a bigger apartment and we would have a comfortable life. You know, that would make a big difference in our world, you know, $250,000. But I didn't do it. And I want you to understand why. And she said, because if I did that, then I say no one would know, but I would know. So that would be hanging behind me. There would be there in my life. There would be this anxiety waiting for that knock on the door, waiting for that letter from the police department, from the tax department. And so we've only got each other. It's just you and me. We're together. If I get caught and I get locked up, then you're on your own. You get taken into care. And you've lost me, I've lost you, we've lost everything. And so even though you know, I could get you a new bicycle, we could move to a bigger apartment, I chose not to do this. I chose to tell the boss what had happened and that I didn't pocket the money. What do you think? You know, and so she said, her boy went, well, I kind of understand. It would be nice to have a bigger place, and I would like a bike, but I understand. That's cool. That's cool. And I thought, she said, do you think I did the right thing? And I said, absolutely. Not only did you do the right thing, not to pocket the money and defraud the realtor, but to tell your son and to walk him through your own mental process. I mean, that's the most fantastic gift you could give to your boy. Because he will remember that as long as he lives. And he'll know, my mother loves me so much that she wouldn't do this. She would not do this for me because my mother loves me. So I said, that's the most marvelous gift you could have given your child. And I said, well, so what happened to the, what did the boss say when you told him? She said, he was kind of impressed. He was glad I hadn't ripped him off. But, I think there might be a bonus this month. But, you know, the boss was also appreciative, like, wow, I've got a really honest person on my staff. This is great. And so then she didn't say whether she got the bicycle for her boy, but the boss was impressed and touched that she was so honest. Also that she hadn't just gone quiet, but she told him. And my suspicion was that if he was a good boss, he said, you know, here's an extra $1,000 this month. You know, this is a bonus. Get your boy a bike. And so that I feel is a really good example of mindfulness and morality. That she was watching her mind states. What she acknowledged the temptation, she could see very quickly how she could do it and hide it, but also that she was mindful of the consequences. There was okay in the Buddha's teachings, there's a set of seven qualities of a well-rounded person. One of the first qualities is dhammanyutta, like reflect the ability to reflect on causes. And then the second quality is attanyutta, A-T-T-H, attanyutta, the reflecting on consequences. So she is demonstrating that quality of a well-rounded person, a sapurisa. These are the consequences. This is where it's going to go. Okay, with that in mind, then she let go. So that that mindfulness is not just mindfully sort of taking the precepts, and it's also watching your mind, what your mind does around the precepts. And then also, I said, so how does it feel? How do you feel now? She said, good, actually. Especially since I'd praised her. But she said, yeah, I feel good. I feel really glad I did that because my heart is at peace. So there's a mindfulness of also recognizing, having acted in that skillful way, how does it feel? Great. It's a good feeling. Okay, Remember that. Remember that. Just as if you'd done something that was unskillful, that hiriyotapa, that kind of pain in the heart, like, ooh, I shouldn't have done that, or ooh, I don't want them to find out, or wait, you know, I don't want the boss to know about that one. And that, to acknowledge if we have caught sin or broken a precept, that hiriyotapa, that painfulness in the heart. So all of that, I would say, is part of mindfulness, and also how mindfulness guides us towards developing the quality of well-being, how to live skillfully, and the happiness, the contentment of heart that comes from skillful living. So, any other questions? From a Chevron person. Maybe from a Chevron person, since I know neither of you guys are Chevron people. I know you from other places. Very good. You're wearing the badge, so I know that you're part of the company.
Told me that when you're someone about 6 years, you found your mind produce a lot of thought, and I would like to know, once Pajan apply mindfulness, what is the result of your thought? Is it decrease, increase, or is still bad? Something.
Can you speak up a bit?
I mean, when you found your mind think a lot, when you found that, I would like to know, when you apply mindfulness, how about your thought decrease, or is still, but you can make it more better?
Well, it's a good question. So what I realized was that my habit was to be worrying all the time. So there was a lot of thoughts, and they were mostly, what's going to happen? What do people think of me? Is this going to work? I want this to be good. Is it going to be good? I want to catch the plane. Are we going to get there in time? So the instruction that I got from Lumpur Sumedho at that time, he was talking a lot about mindfulness of thought and mindfulness of emotion, was to use the physical body. Because what I didn't realize was that worry, anxiety, is supported a lot by physical tension. And so it might seem a different thing, but what Lumpur Sumedho pointed to is that often the emotions that we have, they are reflected in the body. And the anxiety, I would feel like a kind of knot of tension in the gut, in the belly. And so in terms of mindfulness of emotion, Lumpur would suggest when your mind is lost in an emotion, in worry or in fear or in desire, anger, feel it in the body. Notice where the reaction of the body, and then be aware of that, and then relax. Relax that. So what I did was, this was such a strong habit, I made a program for myself. Okay, in the morning sitting every day, like we would meet for morning meditation, 5 o'clock every day. So between 5 o'clock and 6:30, the morning meditation, I make this adhitana, this dang jai. Okay, during today, whenever the mind moves towards worry, anxiety, or fear of anything, it's inside or outside, whatever it is, notice that. Be aware, this is the feeling of worry. Bring the attention into the body. Feel, what's the body doing? If there's tension in the gut or in the shoulders or wherever, then relax. Let the body relax. And then, the next part is really interesting. Then, ask yourself, what was it that you were worrying about? What was the problem? What is the problem? So I made a kind of project of that. That was like my main focus for the meditation for 2 or 3 years. Because it was a strong habit. So I knew I had to kind of focus on it in a deliberate way. So I would do that, and then every time my mind was worried about catching a plane or what somebody thought of me or whether some project I was doing was going to work or not or whatever it might be, I'd bring the attention to the body, and sure enough there's this tightness in the belly, in the stomach. So then I would notice that, feel that tension, and then consciously relax. Yeah, often also using the Lom Hai Jai Ok, the out-breath, to help the body to relax. That's nature's way of relaxing, the out-breath. Relax the body, and then it would relax quite quickly, and let the body relax. And then it was really interesting to ask, okay, what was it that I was worrying about? What's the problem? Oh yes, and it always took 2 or 3 seconds to remember what the problem was, because without the body feeding that tension, kind of there is no problem. That if it's not too long a word, the problematicness of that thing was not there. So that was, I found, very revealing. That 2 or 3 seconds of, yeah, the problem is, oh yes. And because if you're kind of quick, you realize, oh, if I don't make it a problem, it's not a problem. You know, we're still in England. Amaravati is close to Heathrow Airport, and the road that connects the local town and Heathrow Airport is called the M25. It's like a circular motorway all around London. It's also known as Europe's biggest car park, because we specialize in Lodit on the M25. So it's quite common to be on the M25 not moving while you're theoretically on your way to Heathrow Airport. So you're sitting in the van, not moving. We've got 25 minutes to check in. We're not moving. And then, you're going to miss the plane. And to notice that, to relax. And then ask the question, what's the problem? What is there to worry about? And then it would take a couple of seconds to remember, oh, the plane, we might miss the plane. But in those moments, there isn't a problem. You're still stuck on the motorway, you're not moving. But at that moment, it is not a problem. So it doesn't mean that you're passive or you don't take any action. But if you can understand, it's a tricky English word, the problematicness, the calling it a panha, calling it a panha, is what the mind adds to it. Just yesterday at the Dhamma talk at Maya Gautami Foundation, Ajahn Kongrit was quoting a former British Prime Minister. I was very impressed. He could quote British politicians from ages gone by. So when Harold Macmillan was the Prime Minister of the UK in the 1950s. They had the Suez Crisis, and there was this big conflict between Israel and Egypt and the Suez Canal, and there was this major tensions in the area. And a reporter came to Harold Macmillan and said, "Mr. Prime Minister, What's your opinion about the problem in the Middle East, in Suez?" And he said, "There is no problem." But Mr. Prime Minister, I mean, this is kind of, I can't understand why you would say that, because you have the Arab forces are aligned with the Egyptian army, and then the Israelis have got their tanks there, and there's the airplanes are armed, and the bombing has been happening here and there. The situation is really tense. How can you say there's no problem? And he said, to call it a problem assumes there is a solution. There is no solution, so it's not a problem. Now, maybe that's a bit too revolutionary for Chevron. And if you start saying that to your boss, and you say, look, I pay you to find solutions. But Ajahn Amaro said, he was quoting Harold Macmillan, there isn't a solution, it's not a problem. Right? So, with all due respect to your management team and not trying to cause too many difficulties at Chevron, it's talking about being mindful of how we frame a situation. That if we call it a problem, then it creates that sense of tension. So in answer to your question, after 2 or 3 years of working on that, I found my mind kind of relates to those things radically different way. It just doesn't get lost in those kind of worried thoughts. I'm not making any claims, but the mind has learned how not to be anxious about things that it calls imperfect. Yeah. There was a passage, a line from an ancient Chinese scripture from the third Chan patriarch, Seng San, where he says to live in the middle way is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. So you meet something that is imperfect. It shouldn't be that way. This is unfinished. It needs to be fixed or arranged or changed. But you can see that imperfection and recognize, well, yeah, something needs to be done there, but it doesn't have to be a source of anxiety. It doesn't have to be the kind of create, the stress around it. You can recognize, yeah, there's some work needs to be done there, that wall needs to be completed or that project needs to be finished, but it doesn't have to be a source of stress. So I found I was reflecting on those words a lot, to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Because I realized I'm a perfectionist, and anytime things weren't exactly how they should be, creep. So it changed that in a radical way. And another thing I might add was in this area, when Lumpur Liam came to Wat Apaikiri in California, visited our monastery many years ago when I lived there, and somebody asked him, Lumpur Liam is now the abbot of Wat Bapong, in our main monastery in Ubon, and somebody asked him, you know, Lumpur, what was the biggest obstacle that you had, or the greatest difficulty in your training as a monk? And he said, well, when I was younger, then fear was a big issue. I had a lot of fear, and that was an obstacle. Then he stopped and he said, well, you know, to call it an upasak, to call it an obstacle, that's really not quite right, because it's exactly these kind of things that help us to raise our game, to develop our skills. So if you call it a problem or an obstacle, you're looking at it in a very negative way. But rather you should think of this as an opportunity to raise your game. You know, you are in a football team and you're just playing against the next borough or the next village, and you know your team is way better than them. You get onto the football pitch and it's easy to play because you know you're going to beat them, and because your group is much, much better. But if you play against the district champions, then you, oh my goodness, they're really good. So you've got to really pay attention. You've got to raise your game because the competition is much hotter. It's much more challenging. So Lumpur Liam said, it's like that. You know, it's like you should change the attitude to recognize this is how we improve ourselves. And so that rather than difficulties or challenging situations being just a source of suffering and stress, then the mind flips it around. Say, well, oh, interesting. Well, what are we going to do with this one? Rather than, oh no, not one of these. It's a change of attitude. So again, with mindfulness, what we're doing is recognizing the mind's habitual reactions. And then like the Buddha saying, recognizing if you get on that track, it's just going to lead to more conflict and suffering. Okay, don't go down that track. Go down this track instead, to relate to that with wisdom, with skillfulness, and then those obstacles, those challenges, they become something that teaches you, that is beneficial, liberating. So that then, so anyway, I'm not making any boasts or claims, but my mind just doesn't create worry in the same way. It doesn't do that. So I am have living proof in my own life of how effective that kind of approach is. By changing the attitude, your life can really be free of worries. And on paper, I have a lot of responsibilities. You know, I'm the abbot of the biggest monastery in Europe, in the West. I'm the preceptor. I have to do the ordinations for the nuns community, the monks community. All kinds of things, you know. My name's on a lot of programs, but it's not stressful. I mean, again, I'm not boasting, but it's just because of having had really good guidance from my teachers and putting that into action, then it just changes the whole way the heart relates to the world. But mindfulness tells me it's now 12:44. So it's probably time to wrap up. And you've got work to go to. Your Dhyan and Dhamma opportunity is coming to an end. So thank you for your good attention.
On behalf of Chevron and friend, I would like to thank President Amaro for your kindness, giving, offering us the words of the Buddha. Khapunkha. ค่ะกลับพาพร้อมกันนะคะ
very well
คุณไพโรจน์มอบพวงมาลัยให้กับพระอาจารย์